it's Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah to all. This is John McMullen, John Mack the Sun. Welcome you to 170th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 169 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C 13 at .com, www.johnmack13.com. My last piece for Western Guardian, the 212th, is still available, still, after almost 3 months. That website, www.westchesterguardian.com, and Westchester Guardian is WESTCHESTERGUARDIAN.com. It's hopefully left up there to be read by every living American, and I, of course, hope that they do. It is the last Creative Disruption series in the paper, as after the September 29th issue of the paper, the Westchester Guardian joined the likes of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, the New York Journal American, and Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. Of the newspaper is the curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. And in technology, there's the real focus on artificial intelligence, big data, machine learning, and what lies ahead. Try to subscribe. It's free and only one email per day. I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings, live or as most do to listen later. The recordings are archived at the website that I mentioned. I hope you'll join us next week in particular for the John Mack Radio Annuals New Year's Show, then every week thereafter at 7 p.m. on Sunday evenings. Then I'm to this show, the 170th in the series, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And I hope we have many calls tonight, because my guests tonight are anyone who calls in to join us. I recognize that most of my regular contacts and listeners are busy today, both for Christmas and for Hanukkah. So I'm leaving it open to anyone who's free to call. And
I'm dreaming of a and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a white
Thank you, Harry Lewis Crosby. He wants to sing it again. Thank you, Harry Lewis Crosby. My memories of Christmas, of course, go way back to when I was a child, and I remember growing up with all anticipation for gifts, as many children are, and having specific things that I was very interested in. I remember getting a sound effects for radio, and obviously that stayed with me because here we are on the radio, and I see we have one guest here so far from the Washington area, who's been a guest on the show a number of times, journalist Karen DeWitt. Good evening, Karen.
Hey, good evening, you guys, and Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah. I'm celebrating them both.
You are. That's terrific. When you were in the Mideast and in Africa, tell us about when you were there and how Christmas was celebrated in these places, if you were there over Christmas.
Oh, I was there over Christmas in Beirut. All the Christians, whether they were Latin or, as I was, a Roman Catholic, or whether they were Melkite Christians, everybody celebrated Christmas. And it was pretty much like it is here, actually. The Christmas that was different was when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ethiopia, because they have a different calendar. The Ethiopian Christmas begins, I think it's Friday or Saturday of next week. I think it starts on the 2nd and runs through the 7th.
Now, in both Beirut and in Ethiopia, the weather was probably very, very different that Christmas, where they still sleigh bells in the snow and songs like that.
Well, I mean, if you were Western, yeah, people played those songs, but there was no snow in December. It was cooler and more rainy. It's springtime in Ethiopia, so the weather was very nice and dry and pretty. So, but it's also 8,000 feet up in the air, so it was cold at night.
Okay. Okay. We've talked a number of times about politics and about your concerns with the new administration. Do you feel any over the holidays, or are you still all wired up about politics?
No, I don't feel any mellower. I don't feel panicked. I just am not happy about this. I don't think it's good for our country that we have Wall Street billionaires and military people that even the military has said were people that shouldn't be in charge are going to be in charge. But, hey, that's what Americans wanted, so we're going to ride this out for the next 4 years.
That's where we are, right? I was talking about when I was young. One of my earliest memories of when I was old enough to go on to be out of grammar school and to be going to midnight mass was at Good Shepherd Church. You'd be waiting outside from 11 to 11:30 to get a seat, or to 11:15, then let you in, and then you'd be waiting in there for a good half an hour and until mass started. And Good Shepherd as was in Inwood, and as I mentioned many times on this show, Inwood was the northern tip of Manhattan Island, where there were more bars in that neighborhood than any neighborhood in New York City. So many bars that Walter Winchell used to call the Ginwood. Well, we're in church, and it's 20 to 12, and everyone is fairly quiet. There's the little murmuring going back and forth, and all of a sudden, I do hear this fellow, who was a doorman, who apparently had been waiting to come to church in a local gin mill, and all of a sudden, you hear this very loud voice. All right, God damn it, let's get the show on the road. So they ushered him out. I don't know where he celebrated his Christmas. Another story that I remember, there was the mother of a friend of mine, Frank Muldaur, his mother, Ellen Muldaur, off the boat from Ireland, was a very funny but caustic witted woman. And for some reason, if she didn't know people, she very early, when she met some of the Frank's friends, took a disliking to them. And she felt this way about a friend of mine who we called Bugsy at that time, because I recalled the pitcher for New York Giants from the early 19 teens who had the name, the same name of this fellow. People thought I named him that because he had thick glasses but I did not. So, but she didn't care for him very much. So we came up, he and I came up to call for Frank on the Christmas day. And we were probably 17, 18, just 17 or 18, where the drinking law in New York was 18 at the time. And Mr. Moser, the very quiet, tall Irishman, said, "Oh, would you have one with me, boys, for the holiday?" So we said, "Fine." And Bugsy, unfortunately, had been ulcer. And for some reason, he had gotten into his head, maybe there are medical reasons for it, but I had never heard them, that drinking scotch was better for you than drinking any of the liquor if you had an ulcer. So as Miss Meldrew goes into the liquor cabinet and brings out this Crown Royal in the purple bag and obviously the best liquor in the house, and he's opening and he's beginning to pour it, and Bugsy says, "Oh, do you have any scotch?" And you hear this voice from the kitchen: "They serve scotch in Ryan's down on Broadway." So obviously she caught that. Well, I played Bing Crosby's White Christmas earlier. One of the two records that we used to play that she hated more than anything was Clyde McFadder and the Drifters rendition.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where those treetops listen and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow, the snow. But then I am dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write. May your days, may your days be merry and bright. And may all your Christmases be white.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and the children listen to hear bells in the snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write.
May those days, may your days, may your days be merry and bright. And may all Christmases be white.
Jingle bells, jingle all the
Clyde McFadden. Were you a rhythm and blues of the rock and roll fan, Karen?
Oh, I know that song. I don't. It wouldn't be my favorite. It wouldn't be my least favorite. I actually like Eartha Kitt sing Santa Baby.
Okay. The flip side of this song was the Bells of St. Mary, but the record that she hated the most that we used to play was Conway Twitty's version of Danny Boy, which coming off the boat from Ireland would not have been her favorite. Many of the Irish don't like Danny Boy to begin with, but then we get then when you have Conway singing Danny Boy, she was not happy. Other stories. Do you have any Christmas stories that you remember from your childhood? Do you want to share with us?
Oh, me? Am I your only guest right now?
You're only one so far. Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Oh, geez. I like all of Christmas, and I just like the cold weather. And I remember coming out of church, and there was a beautiful little girl who came up to me and gave me a kiss, and I that's what I remember mostly. I didn't really have any I didn't have any anticipation. I just liked the whole season. Everybody's nice between Christmas and New Year's. I don't know what happens to people. They slow down and they're just decent, and that's what I like about Christmas. I don't do a lot of shopping. As somebody said to me, they said, "Are you ready for Christmas?" And I said, "Yes," because everybody's grown up, and everybody's got a job, and now we exchange things that are made. So I made Christmas Stolen, and I'm an incredible peanut brittle maker. I make best brittle you have ever tasted. If the brittle sticks to your teeth, it's not good peanut brittle. It should be shafts. It should be shards of the candy, and it shouldn't stick to your teeth. And I am asked each year by several friends, son and daughter-in-law, when they ask me for Christmas present, I either make bindituck, which is a Korean pancake dish. One of my friend's son-in-law is Korean-American, and he says I make better bindituck than his mother, and that is the highest compliment I could possibly get. It's a mung bean pancake with a dipping sauce. And the other thing that I make is, as I said, incredible peanut brittle that is amazing.
How did you learn how to make Korean dishes?
Oh, there's a wonderful program online. I can't think of the name of what it's called. It's a woman whose father was obviously African-American, and her mother was Korean, and her mother gave her up to a couple, an African-American military guy and his wife, who I think is a Latina, and she was raised in America. And when she was grown up, she went looking for her mother, reconnected, and has now reconnected with all her Korean relatives, and she's married to a famous German chef. And there's a program on PBS, and I have her book on Korean cooking.
Don't surprise me about Korea. I had a Korean student about 3 years ago, and for one of the presentations that she made, she talked about beauty in Korea, and apparently the operation that's given to many, many, many Korean girls as a high school graduation gift is operations to round the eyes, to make them look
Western.
Yeah, and I can't understand why they'd be trying to fly in the face of their own culture.
Well, yeah, but Western culture dominates a lot of the world. In Africa, a lot of women lighten their skin, even though they're beautiful, have beautiful brown skin. African Americans for a long time, African American women straightened their hair until they sort of recognized my hair is what it is, and that's still a challenge, because a young woman who wears dreads or her hair in cornrows or in twists, that might be a bit of a problem in getting a job. I remember once, mostly I wear my hair straight, and as I've gotten older, it's straighter and thinner. But I remember a good friend of mine saying to me one time when I wore it natural, she said, "Oh, you look so ethnic." And I said, "Honey, I am ethnic." I mean, it was like, that cookbook is called, the program is called Kimchi Chronicles, and you can get it on PBS. A great, great show.
The person that I attribute the most trend or the trend to wear their hair natural was Cecily Tyson, where all of a sudden she was considered beautiful in different shows, and then you'd see more and more black girls with curly hair. Do you remember much before?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, way before that. When I was in high school, there was a woman, she's a judge now, her name is Peggy Cooper Jr., because she was adopted, and she was named after her stepmother, and she was called Peggy Cooper Jr., and she is now a judge in New York, and she was fair, light enough to look white if you didn't look closely, and she was the first person that I knew to get her hair cropped, and I remember the Jack and Jill mothers were all sort of saying, "Well, why did Peggy do that? She was such a pretty girl. Why did she do that?" But she was just amazing, and she's worn her hair cropped short ever since.
You mentioned the lightening of the skin and everything, which of course Michael Jackson was accused of. But I remember the story, and it just called to mind the other day with an article that I read in the New York Times, that in the Horns and American Family, Gail Wilmette Buckley, who's a friend, wrote about when her mother Lena Horne was in the movie in Hollywood. She was out there with her, and Lena took her down to a local Girl Scout or Brownie troop, and the people said, "Oh well, wouldn't she be happier in this troop, which was up in Watts or in some other neighborhood, you know?" And when Lena didn't seem pleased with this, then the answer was, "Well, she has very light skin, so maybe she'll be happy here, you know." But it was, I guess, there was all the idea of people who were passing or trying to pass or whatever, you know, which was awful, really, at the time. I have someone else on from the 848 area code, and who do I have there from the 848 area code?
It might be me. It might be Bob Abbott. I'm not sure the area code. I'm calling you from New Jersey.
Oh, hello, Robert. How are you? Speaking of Americans, and this is an inside story, Karen. I was speaking at the food pantry yesterday to Joe Kersley, who I know that you spoke to once. Bob has been interviewing veterans of World War II and Korea, and others, Karen, where he's putting together this whole great series of interviews before these people go away.
Oh, you should.
Yeah, and Joe hasn't been there for almost a year. This is the World War II vet. His twin brother was also in the service. And I mentioned you to him, and he said, yes, I spoke to him, and he said he was going to call back to interview me, but I haven't heard from him. And then he told my wife, when she was saying goodbye to him, he said that he wanted to come back to here because this might be his last time. So maybe you should give him a call again.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking to Bob, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to jump off and go get some champagne, and happy holiday to you both.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen.
All
right. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bob, back to you.
I spoke to Joe. I spoke to Joe two times going back a couple of months.
Okay.
I know he's up in Peekskill.
Right.
And I was hoping to get on by, but so far I haven't been able to do it, and I certainly hope I can. But I apologize to him for any miscommunication that may have ensued.
He may be in the VA hospital. You have had some great stories about...
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
About Christmas. Stories in the rehab type place, perhaps. Would you share the one about Santa Claus and what you put together for the people who had written?
I'm down here and... I'd be more than that. In fact, that's why I wanted to call. I'm down here in Jersey. I just left my family. They're still in the middle of celebrating, and I tell them I need to go make a phone call. And I become basically in my family at Christmas time a Scrooge, and it's for the following reason. When we first moved into our home for the first time back in 1972, we were watching Johnny Carson one night with his sidekick Ed McMahon, and they were reading something and laughing and kind of poking fun back and forth. And, you know, I said to my wife, I don't know what is funny about what they're reading. And they continued on. At the end, they said, and if anyone's interested in one of these letters to Santa Claus, go to your local post office and probably you can pick one up. My wife's family lived in Yorkville, so we were going down to the city the next day, and I stopped at the Bronx Post Office, 149th Street. Now, you got to remember, this is 1972. They had no security. I walk into the postmaster's office. He said, how can I help you? And I said, well, I was watching Johnny Carson last night. I'd like to get a Santa Claus letter. And he said, oh, he said, that pile over there on the table, we haven't had a chance to sort them down. He said, pick the one you like and take it. And I said, well, I'm parked downstairs. I can't take the time now. Can I take the pile? I'll pick a card, a letter, and I'll bring the rest back. And he said, yeah, just make sure you bring them back tomorrow. So I got in the car, and I said to my wife, look, I'm driving, you read. And it was the first and last time there was utter silence in the car the entire time. I got into the city. I parked the car. I looked at her, and I said, which letter are we going to pick? And she looked at me very seriously, and she said, no, you're going to have to do that. And I thought to myself, what's this all about? So that night we got home, and I read the letters, and I realized very quickly what she meant. With one exception, there was not one child that wanted me, gimme. It was something for mommy, something for daddy. Daddy doesn't work. Mommy cries all the time. Something for a young brother, a young sister. So you couldn't pick one. I decided to pick them all. I called the post office. I told the guy, I'm going to answer all the letters. He said, hey, don't BS me here. Those kids are expecting an answer. I said, don't worry. We'll get an answer. And I went to my personnel department. I had them write a letter basically saying I was gainfully employed and this was not a ripoff. And I started going to companies in the Bronx, Alexander's, the phone company, got very, very little in the way of donation. But my dad was a New York City fireman. And I lived in Riverdale before I moved to Yonkers. I went to the 50th precinct and I spoke to the desk sergeant and told him what I was doing. And we ended up being able to make copies of every letter we received. And we had about 30 letters. And we went to basically every police precinct and firehouse in the borough of the Bronx and posted the letters with my name and my phone number. And within about a week or 10 days, I started getting firemen and policemen coming to the front door, knocking on the door, ringing the bell, bringing gently used clothing and games that their kids had never worn, had worn once or twice and had grown out of. And I ended up, the entire downstairs of my house was filled with almost 300 gifts for these kids. My wife wrapped every gift. And on Christmas Eve, 8 o'clock in the morning outside the Yankee Stadium, we got a two-car police escort to deliver those gifts, starting in the South Bronx and working our way up to the North Bronx throughout the day. And it was a day full of emotions. I remember one girl specifically, she was on dialysis, and she wrote, Dear Santa Claus, I'm on dialysis. It was 3 or 4 times a week for 3 or 4 hours each time. I like a sewing kit and a book, something to keep me busy while I'm going through the procedure. We got off the elevator in her project. I went down. I knocked on the door. And in every case, we presented ourselves as Santa's helpers from the post office. The father answered the door. You know, I explained to him why we were there. I showed him his daughter's letter. And he said to me, tell me who you really are. And we told him, with Santa's help us. And he didn't believe me, but he took me into his daughter's bedroom and we gave her the gifts. And he followed me down the hall into the elevator. Yes, a half a dozen times. No, tell me who you really are. So finally, in the elevator, I said, look, and I told him about the letters and so forth. And he gives me a bear hug and a kiss. She says, God damn it, he says, I knew it. I know there's no Santa Claus, but I believe in you. And that was just emblematic of the day. It was a very, very emotionally ridden day. But as a result of that, to this very day, when I go to see my grandkids at Christmas time or I see other relatives, it's almost an immoral act in my mind how the kids can't go from gift to gift fast enough. They can't open the gifts fast enough to get to the next one. So as I said earlier, I've become the Grinch of Christmas in my family because every year I think of those young kids. And I've often thought now, you know, those kids now are older than I was that very, very distant Christmas. And I often wondered what kind of lives they had. I would think in many cases probably not all that good a life. Hopefully I'm wrong. But that's my Christmas story. And as I say, it's something I relive every year.
It's interesting. You're talking about the way people react. Barbara and I work every Saturday morning in the food pantry in Lake Mohegan in town of Yorktown. And people tend to think, well, if people are coming in that they're not going to be gracious or they're going to think you owe them something. And it's just the opposite. These people are the most thankful people. Thank you very much. And there was one fellow who brought us Christmas cards, all of us. And within the last 2 weeks, we had to do it in 2 weeks because of the snow last week. We gave food and toys and clothes to approximately 300 families. And it's just a wonderful feeling, as you've had the same feeling in giving out those toys, you know? So,
Oh, yes.
Would you go a little more before you go in, before you go off, about to what your project is in the event that I have any veterans listening or that are going to download the show?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I tell people my most vivid childhood memory was a 3-year-old kid sitting in my kitchen in South Bronx. My mother and father exploded in a kaleidoscope of emotions. The war's over, the war's over, the war's over. Hugging, kissing, dancing, screaming, crying. I had no idea what the words meant, but I knew something special had happened. And that was either the victory in Europe or the victory in Japan. And I grew up at a very young age. To me, nothing more honorable than to serve my country. And now here I am, I'm 75 years old, and for the last 25 years, I've been interviewing those men. They literally, without any doubt at all, they literally saved the world. My grandson just tonight, who couldn't open his gifts fast enough, is 7 years old. When he comes to my house, if I don't have his favorite ice cream, I get a little bit of a tongue lashing. Gee, Bob, you knew I was coming. How come? He's 7. The average World War II veteran, if he was 18 on December 7, 1941, was born in 1923. And at the tender age of 6, 1 year younger than my grandson, the Depression hit. And they learned that day that there's no such thing as free food. Forget ice cream and refrigerators. There's no such thing as free food. Do whatever you could do to help mommy and daddy survive, put food on the table, whether it was shining shoes, delivering newspapers, whatever they could do. And they did that for 12 years until December 7th. And I believe without the slightest doubt in my mind, that 12 years of shared sacrifice and thinking of something other than themselves and something more important than themselves is what prepared them to go forth and sacrifice the way they did for World War II. Basic training was certainly helpful, but the thing that steeled these men and created their personalities and their resolve was growing up as young kids and teenagers learning about doing for the common good. So, yeah, they saved the world. It was literally a world war. And these guys, as we all know, are fewer and fewer. And every chance I get to interview these men, I take it. I've been doing it now since about 1998, thereabouts. So, you know, going on 20 years. And I don't have too many of those guys left anymore. I can count on one hand the number of men I've interviewed who are still with us. But I feel a moral obligation to tell their stories because we take it for granted. Freedom is not free, and we need to know what sacrifice these men made. And I find very, very few people are even interested in hearing about it. And that I am, I'm embarrassed to say, included my family tonight at dinner. So that's what I do.
And have you the plan for what you're going to do with all these interviews that you have?
Well, at the very least, if you know, I would love to get a book published. I wrote a book years ago. I never got it published. Nobody was interested. Doesn't surprise me. But I have the book. It's written. I've got about 300 hours of tape-recorded interviews. And if nothing else, at some point in time, I'll deliver it to the Library of Congress, probably. But the point was, I didn't interview these men with the idea of writing a book. I interviewed these men because it was my way of saying thank you for what you did, because without you guys, I wouldn't be here, my family wouldn't be here, and it's just my way of saying thank you. And I know if these men were alive, they're too gracious to even say they did anything. Well, they did, as far as they're concerned, was they did their duty. The only guys they thought did anything worthwhile didn't come home. I respectfully disagree. So anytime I get a chance, whether it be on your show, and I thank you for it, or anywhere else, when I get a chance to tell these men's stories, I jump at the opportunity to tell it.
A friend of mine was very close to Bill Gallo, who was the sports cartoonist and the columnist for the New York Daily News. And Bill, who's no longer with us, was 18 years old, and he was offshore in Iwo Jima, knowing they were going to land the next day. And he told my friend that every one of us expected to die. He didn't. Most of his friends did. But these people expecting to die all went off the boat. None of them hid downstairs. None of them said, "How do I go AWOL?" They all went. And I just can't imagine doing something like that, or the way, or many people that I see around doing something like that. You know, it's your feelings on that.
Well, I totally agree. I'm not playing particularly with the services, but these guys were Marines, and Marines are a band of brothers, as is the Army. And the worst thing you could do would be to not stand behind your brother, to shirk your duty. And you also realize what they were fighting for. They were fighting for their country. They weren't fighting for themselves. That was tertiary. They were fighting for their brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and family and friends. And to them, there was nothing more glorious than to die if, as a result of their death, it helped their family and their nation survive. So, as I say, once again, they were 18-year-old, 19-year-old kids, but they had been through 12 years of the Depression. Their character was molded in steel. They knew what deprivation was, and they knew what sacrifice was, and there was no need to sit down and try to figure how to get out of it, because they were in it for that purpose. They were in it to win, and they were in it to find to get the freedom that they were able to find, and that's what separates them from any other generation. You know, I call them America's greatest generation because of the fact that they went around the world, and they didn't go around the world to try and get gold or land. They went because they knew they had to fight the enemy, otherwise this country would perish. And God bless them for their spirit and their sacrifice and their determination. And that's why I say their story needs to be told. It needs to be told.
What I read, at least one person saying that you can have all these high ideals, but he said, but when you're in the battle, he said, you're not fighting for your country or for the president of the United States, you're fighting for your platoon and your friends, that you won't let them down. And I think that makes
that's
sense.
That's right. It's a brotherhood.
Absolutely. Have you considered trying to reach out to Tom Brokaw or to someone who's already written a book about Our Greatest Generation or something like that.
Now, you know, it's funny you say Tom Brokaw because there was a local newspaper here in Yonkers called the Journal News, and they had a weekly column called First Person. Anybody could write in about anything if it was a first-person personal experience. And I wrote in, and this is going back almost 20 years, when I first started interviewing these guys, and I called them in the article. I said, I consider these guys to be the greatest generation in American history. And about 6 months later, Brokaw's book came out, The Greatest Generation. My first
right.
reaction, I said to my wife, that SOB, he stole my title. Of course he didn't. But now I have found out, even as recently as, you know, this last month or so, reaching out to newspapers, to the television, for the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. One of my guys went back for the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, a guy named Chick DeLella from Tarrytown, New York. He was there on December 7, 41, and he went back. He went back with his 18-year-old grandson. And I said to him, Chick, I said, I'm glad you're going back, but what I'm even happier about is you're taking your 18-year-old grandson, because he and his fellow friends probably know nothing about Pearl Harbor. And Chick told me, he said, that's right. The only reason he knows about Pearl Harbor is because I'm his grandfather. But there's a young guy, he's an internet sensation in about the last 2 months. His name is Rishi Sharma. He's a native-born Indian, not from the, you know, U.S. and American Indian, but from the country of India. And for the last 2 years, he has been interviewing nonstop pretty much every day World War II veterans, to the point where he declined his college admission. He said he had something more important to do than to go to college. And the question was, what's more important than getting an education? He said, interviewing World War II veterans, because without them, I wouldn't be here. And I have a duty, and they're dying at the rate of a couple of hundred a day. And I cannot sit in a class and read a book knowing I could be interviewing these men. And he apparently was able to raise enough funds to go to Pearl Harbor. My veteran, Chuck DeLella, was getting out of his elevator in Honolulu wearing his Pearl Harbor survivor cap. And in the lobby was Rishi Sharma. Rishi came over, introduced himself, and interviewed my guy. And my guy turned around and said to his grandson, he said, this fellow here, not even born in the United States, is so dedicated to learn what we do. You got to tell your friends to step up and do the same thing. So, that's about as close as I've gotten to talking with Rishi Sharma.
There was a review in the Wall Street Journal. Saturday Wall Street Journal has a section that you probably know called Review, and it's there's book reviews and a whole bunch of things. And it's a review of the book about Jimmy Stewart. I knew he was a World War II vet. I didn't know that he commanded the whole squadron of bombers of B-29s or B-26s in over Germany, and he apparently came back with what would today call PTSD. He was so concerned. They said he was a perfectionist, and he was so concerned that he was going to put his men in jeopardy that it stayed with him after the war ended. And he apparently had some real confidence problems that he didn't know whether he could continue acting. And the story is about his Christmas movie that's played every year. And they say that's what really gave him the confidence to go on. That I had never known that about him.
Yeah. He was in the Army Air Corps, and the casualty rates in the Army Air Corps were well north of 80%. The normal routine, or I couldn't call it a routine, but they had 25. Their tour was 25 flights, and it was quite unlikely any man would make it through 25. And he flew either the B-17 Flying Fortress or the B-24 Liberator. and it was his responsibility. And that's a tremendous responsibility for a young guy. They say they have a picture of him in 1942 and a picture of him in 1945, a difference of about 2.5 to 3 years. And the difference in his appearance is almost like a son and a father, from a young guy to an old man. And apparently that movie was perfect for him because, yes, he did have some kind of PTSD, which would be almost unavoidable. And it gave him the ability to act out both the high part of his of his personality and the low part. Because there's that one time in there when the money in the bank runs out and he kind of flips out and he, you know, he loses it. And he found that to be very cathartic because that was the way he felt and it was what they were looking for in that part in the movie. But I mean, these guys that were in the Army Air Corps, their casualty rates were very, very high.
It's amazing you mentioned the difference in the way he looks. You just have to see pictures of Barack Obama at the beginning of his presidency or the end, or George W. Bush at the beginning of presidency and the end. And they certainly aged more than 12 years, at least facially.
Oh God. Yes.
Well, when you think about it,
I mean, they got the weight of the world on their shoulders 24/7. There's not 1 second in the day, not 1 second in 24 hours where they can just kind of get away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I'd love to. Now you're only doing World War II. You haven't done any Korea?
No, at this point it's World War II. I mean, that's really what I most relate to, and with all due deference to Korea, also to Vietnam. I was very happy in one sense with Vietnam to get a young man into the Manhattan College Hall of Fame who was much overdue in his admission, who everybody just assumed was already in, and it got to be kind of a political shootout. But I was able to get him into the Hall of Fame, and the only reason I was able to get him in was because, or actually I should say to reverse it, it was because of what I had to go through to get him into the Hall of Fame that made me at that point think about World War II veterans. So I know it sounds a little crazy, but the only thing that made me even start to interview World War II veterans was the frustration and opposition I met trying to get a Vietnam veteran who died in service in Vietnam into his Manhattan College Hall of Fame. And that was the impetus to get me then to interview World War II veterans. I know it sounds strange, but life sometimes goes strange.
The interesting thing about Korea is that I've read many times that John Glenn said the best pilot he ever flew with in Korea was Ted Williams. And Ted Williams apparently developed pneumonia landing the plane that people kept telling him to bail out from that was full of bullets and from the smoke he got pneumonia, then he almost died. He had wonderful vision, and apparently it was very useful, but he was shooting at the enemy, obviously. Yeah. So
that vision allowed him as a baseball player to literally see the stitches on a ball coming at him 90 miles an hour.
Right.
Yeah, it was for him, it was like slow motion.
Yeah. Well, when he came back from Korea, he supposedly told Joe Cronin that who was the general manager of the Red Sox at the time, that home plate was off. And Cronin told him he was crazy, and they actually measured it. And it was either an eighth or the sixth of an inch out of line, you know. That's something that I certainly wouldn't have gotten.
Yeah.
Bob, I don't want to keep
incredible.
You.
No, it's just incredible.
I don't want to keep you from your family. Thank you very much for calling in.
No, you're not keeping me from my family, not at all.
And I hope that you and Joe Kersey can get together because he's a wonderful person. And I hope that you know. And
well,
today
I'll tell you what I'm going to do right now. I'll get back probably Monday or Tuesday. I'll give him a call and make every effort to touch base physically face to face.
Yeah, he was on a walker yesterday morning, and it's the first time he'd been there in a year, I'd say. As I mentioned, when Barbara went to say goodbye to him, he said, well, he wanted to get there because it might be his last time. So obviously he's got some forbearance.
Yeah. Well, I'm very sorry to hear that, but I will definitely make it very effort to talk to him and see him.
All right. Merry Christmas and thank you very much.
My pleasure. God bless.
Okay. Good night, Bob. Thank you. Back to old stories about the neighborhood. One of the interesting things was as we got older, I mentioned during the time that we had the Frank the doorman yelling out, we're going to midnight mass. We used to go as we got older and we're going out with girls and everything. We used to take to Faye's restaurant, and Faye's restaurant was on Broadway, just north of 270th Street. And it was formerly Frank Commander's of Frank's restaurant of 125th Street. And I remember a friend of mine with his girlfriend were eating, and he ordered the baked potato for her. And when she dug into the baked potato, she came out with an engagement ring. So that supposedly, and I never heard of it, was an old Irish way of you give the person that you want to marry that engagement ring. And she said yes after that. Then as I moved along and had my own children, I remember one funny incident. When my daughter was about 6 years old, oh no, she was younger than that. I'm sorry, she was only two or 3 years old. She got a doll for Christmas called Dapper Dan. It was the small doll that you could put clothes on. It taught you how to be able to untie things and to use snaps and everything. And then after she had done going through her presents, we went down to her grandmother's house, and and her aunt was there who gave her a gift. And she opened the wrapping paper, and then right away it said, she looked at it and she said, oh, Dapper Dan, because it was the same gift she already had. And my aunt was convinced that she could read at three, and we did nothing to disabuse her of that belief. Then we go ahead years into my working life to 1977. And in 1977, I was working with the woman who I had met in 1974, I guess, when we made the presentation with my consulting firm that I was with to a company called Bache Halsey Stewart. And Bache Halsey Stewart did not buy what we were selling, but the three-person team that was evaluating it was two fellas and the woman, none of whom I had known before, and we went out for lunch after it, and then a few weeks later we heard that they weren't going to buy. So years later, she had to marry me. In 1977, just 2 days before Christmas, I told her that we're going to get married. And she didn't believe me. A year later, in 1978, about the same time, when we were living in Bedford Hills, New York, and we got in the car to go someplace with two children. And she said, I forgot something, and she went back in the house. Then my daughter, who was probably about 10 at the time, and my son, oh no, she was younger, she was about 8, and my son was about 6. They were, oh, come on, why aren't we going? And then she got back in the car, and we went to wherever we were going, and then we came back, and wow, there were presents under the Christmas tree, and Santa Claus must have been here, and my daughter, there's no Santa Claus, but he didn't figure out what happened. Then I thought that was terrific, very ingenious for my wife. Then as we got older, we used to go down to New Jersey and to Philadelphia at Christmas, and we would stay with some friends of mine, Dr. Molino and his wife, and we used to go into Philadelphia to see my in-laws for one day. And then after a while, unfortunately, my father-in-law got sick and passed away, and my mother-in-law came up to live near us in a very nice assisted living place called the Seabury. And we had Christmas dinner with her a couple of times there, and that was really some of the nicest times that my wife ever had with her mother, because my wife left home to go to college at right after high school, and really never returned other than to visit. So that's a lot of Christmases that I've been through, that I've been happy with, that I've been very lucky. We've been thinking over the holidays about how so many of my friends who either are sick or are no longer with us, that I'm still here. Friends who smoked and had lung cancer. Friends who unfortunately have cancer of the sinus. Friends who had these different diseases. A friend of mine who was in the Army, and Bob mentioned the Army, and he was stationed in Aniwetok, where we had the atomic testing. And he got off the island to play basketball. He was a basketball player, but there was very little to do there. And he died about 5 years ago of cancer, and it was the second time that he had cancer. And just last year, I heard that we were concerned with the fact that with climate change and with the water rising, that there was a concern that Aniwetok was going to be submerged, and that all of the radiation that was still on the island, it was going to spread throughout the Pacific Ocean. Now, whether that's a real concern or not, it shows that we knew that there was a radiation problem there. And I wonder how many other people came down with cancer that was stationed there. Very similar to how so many people that served in Vietnam had to fight to get benefits if they had Agent Orange. So it was if they were exposed to Agent Orange. So we, in a lot of ways, don't take care of our veterans. I heard Congress people voted saying we can't afford to do this, and hearing the 21 veterans from the two Mideast wars commit suicide every month because they aren't getting proper treatment for PTSD. Then that's disgraceful. You know, these people didn't choose to go to the Mideast or to Vietnam, whether or not we're pro the actions that we had there or against them. They weren't a Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon or George W. Bush. They were the people who went where the country asked them. So I hope that this new administration will do what they say, and will try to support veterans better than we've had. Oh, thank you for listening. I'll be sending out copies of the show, posting links. And we were talking about the old neighborhood and a bunch of things. So rather than going off to pretending Mancini again, I'll say, see ya, as we said in the old neighborhood, and I'll go off with From the Horn and Hard Arts Children's Hour every Sunday morning, what we used to hear then. East side, west side, all around the town. But it roses, then bridge is falling down. Boys and girls together, me and Mimi O'Rourke. Oh, it's fantastic on the sidewalks of New York. Down to the town, over the boys and girls together, we would sing while the sidewalks of New York, like west side, all around the town. Things is falling down. Boys and girls together, me and Mimi are rock. That's fantastic. On the sidewalks, you're west all around the town. Boys and girls together, me and Mimi O'Rourke. Commercial information. On my last column, Integrative Disruption, sir, that I mentioned before, by now a collector's piece, appeared in the West of the Guardian, along with columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. It's still online as a collector's piece. You might want to download it. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at medium.com. Send any comments to me at johnmack14@gmail.com. And in a word, the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. I'll be back again next week with the New Year's show. And until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya.
I'm dreaming of
a white
Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where those trees are listen.
Snow.
Then I am dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry and bright.
To listen and love to do.